The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I've never been through a time practicing law in 30 plus years where I felt like we truly are the last line in the sand.
Mike Papantonio talks about the state of trial law and on the proliferation of trial lawyers.
We start seeing people advertising now, and it's projecting that somehow they're capable of handling a case. Well, hell, they've never been to a courtroom. I mean, if you ask them, where does the plaintiff sit in a courtroom, they couldn't tell you.
And on his disdain for easy settlements and compromise.
The only thing that changes anything is when you really hurt a company. When you put somebody out of their job because they made a decision they knew was wrong.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Growing up as a kid, one of Mike Papantonio's favorite books was To Kill a Mockingbird, with its sympathetic lawyer hero Atticus Finch. Today, he's a champion of the abused and victimized. Mike has become known as the King of Mass Torts for his innovative approach to maximizing his cases and client recoveries. It's earned him the Defender of Justice Award by the American Association for Justice, among many other awards. Mike Papantonio sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in late August 2017 to discuss the keys to his success, his keen concern about fellow lawyers, both plaintiff and defense, and the connection between personal innovation and quality of life.
Recently, you won a $920 million settlement against DuPont for pollution from a West Virginia plant, and it's among the numerous multi-million dollar verdicts on behalf of clients who, as you put it in the past, are victims of corporate malfeasance. And you've certainly seen a lot, especially from Wall Street, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, where we are right now is we're at a place where if we don't do our job, then nobody's held accountable. And I mean that more than I think I have. I've never been through a time practicing law in 30 plus years where I felt like we truly are the last line in the sand. We used to be able to believe that the media was there, that corporate media would be there when a pharmaceutical company put out a bad product. But now we understand they're not there because the advertising money is just too big. So when Bayer makes a product that kills people, we don't hear that story in the media. And then we also used to believe that there was the relationship between regulators and the public, where regulators actually did their job to protect the public from so many problems that we're faced with as consumers. But now we've found that the regulatory process has been actually owned and operated by corporate media for about probably the last 15, 20 years. There's been this change of guard where regulators, say with the EPA or the SEC or the FDA, gets a conversation call from, gee, how are you, Joe? Would you like to go to work with us when you get through? And, oh, by the way, we might need some help on this drug. And then we used to believe that the Department of Justice had our backs, but really they don't. If you think about, was it $8 trillion that Wall Street lost from the American economy, and we had Obama coming in saying, well, we're going to do something about that. Well, in the end, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, or none of the Department of Justice, put even one of them in prison. They stole $8 trillion from the American economy. So we have we have in place these myths that, you know, somebody's out there doing their job and everything's going to be okay. But when it comes right down to it, the DuPont case that you talked about just a second ago, that case had been around for 50 years. And in 50 years, regulators did nothing. In 50 years, the corporate-owned media did nothing because the advertising dollars were too big. The Department of Justice did nothing, although they had all the facts. So the last line in the sand truly is trial lawyers. So I take it very seriously, what we do.
What made you want to be a lawyer?
Well, I think everybody is built with certain wiring, and I don't think there's anything Pollyannish to say that sometimes our wiring says that we hate bullies. Sometimes our wiring tells us that we really don't like to see people abused and we really don't like injustice. And I remember, even as a very young high school student, reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and I saw the setting of Atticus Finch placed in an impossible situation where he had to beat up bullies. He had to go after the bullies. He had to do it at great risk and great, huge risk, personally and professionally. And I was moved by that. I think that had a big impact on me.
What were the most important influences in your life growing up, especially maybe those lessons you learned that prepared you for a legal career?
You know, I had a great opportunity. I lived with eight different families growing up. And all of them were everything ranging from blue-collar workers to writers to musicians to one family pilots. So I picked up all of those parts, all those moving parts. I became an artist. I became a musician. I became a writer. I flew airplanes. You know, so all of that kind of coalesced and kind of created the person that I am today, good or bad. That's what came out.
Were you a foster child?
No, I wasn't a foster child. It was just a dysfunctional kind of system that I was placed into. But it was very positive. There's nothing negative about it. It was, you know, I don't go, woe is me. I mean, I come across thinking that what an incredible opportunity, you know, to have learned what I learned along the way.
And my goodness, how you seized on it. Who was your mentor? Did you have one or several?
I've had so many mentors. And I think, for example, in every one of those families that I just talked about, everybody brought something else to the table. You know, it was consistent in the sense that everybody instilled compassion in me. Everybody gave me a sense of rage when things were wrong. You know, these were decent people, understand? These are the kind of people who took in a child that wasn't theirs to help raise. So they had this sense of balance and this sense of justice already. And I think that had a big impact on me growing up. As a lawyer, oddly enough, Leo Thomas, who's a criminal, very well-respected criminal attorney here at the law firm, actually got me my job here. And I think he had a tremendous impact on me, both in the way that he practiced law, but also in the way that he viewed what our role was as lawyers and what our role is outside of the courtroom and outside the role of being a lawyer.
How did you go about honing your trial skills?
I was in charge of the trial program at Cumberland. And the trial program at Cumberland for so many years was it still is in the top five or six trial teams in the United States. But they were just building it back then. And I was put in charge of trying to do that. And so in that process, by the time I graduated from law school, I had 30 to 35 trials that I had actually been in courtroom settings where you can't make a mistake. There is no fudge factor. You have to know evidence. You have to lay predicates. You have to understand the dynamics of a courtroom. You have to understand how to make a compelling argument. And so coming out of Cumberland really gave me a huge advantage. And then I prosecuted after that. And as a prosecutor, trial after trial taught me more and more about the necessity of being a skilled trial lawyer. It's a trade, and you have to know your trade. You can't be a hack in this business that we start seeing people advertising now, and it's projecting that somehow they're capable of handling a case. Well, hell, they've never been to a courtroom. I mean, if you ask them, where does the plaintiff sit in a courtroom, they couldn't tell you. And so I've my entire career have rejected that kind of lawyering and tried to build something just the opposite of that.
What's the most rewarding part of being a plaintiff's attorney? Is it beating up on the bullies?
Yeah, I think it's a big reward when you actually get a result and you understand that but for your effort, this drug would not have been taken from the market, you know, or the drug will still be out there for people. That Yaz is a great example. I mean, it's a product that was killing women between the ages 18 and 35. Had I not done my job, had I not done what I'm supposed to do as a trial lawyer, that drug would still be killing people without any warning.
One particular key to your success, one skill?
I think the biggest skill is the art of self-discipline, the art of focusing, the art of being able to say, I can sit at this table and I can read documents from 7 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. And I can understand the document, and I can get a feel for how I'm going to use that document, and I can project what I'm going to do with that document. But you don't do that by simply having somebody else do your work for you. It's your self-discipline. You have to sit there. At the end of the day, it's your trial, and you have to be responsible for that.
You have become, as one of your colleagues mentioned, the king of mass torts. What is a mass tort, and what's the difference between it and a class action?
Well, a mass tort is nothing like a class action. Matter of fact, I really started building mass tort litigation because I was so offended by class action. Class action is really a, kind of a bottom feeder kind of process in many ways. It's a process where you, at the end of the day, there's story after story where a class action is settled. The clients who are affected get nothing or little. They get coupons, and the lawyers make $100 million. I was so offended by that as a young lawyer when I started this business that I went toe-to-toe against the whole class action aspect of lawyering and said, look, we can get 10,000 cases and we can try them one at a time forever if we have to. And at some point, the defendant is going to understand they have to settle, or they're going to have to settle these cases, or they're going to have to try these cases for the rest of the next CEO and the next CEO. And so that was, it's built differently. It's where you actually are engaged with the client, and you're trying to really get a great result for the client. And in the process, if you get a great result for the first three or four clients, then you get a great result for the thousand that might come after them.
Interesting. How helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
I think self-reflection is totally necessary. You know, I wrote 3 books as a young lawyer because I think attorneys have such a poor capacity to be honest with themselves about who they are. There's not a lot of self-awareness. I think that comes because this is an intense business. And so you build images of yourself that may not be accurate. You know, you'll have some character advertising from Florida to California about, you know, his law firm and how important they are and what great things they accomplish. And in the end, they start believing it even if they don't do it. So that is what I talk about, the necessity for self-awareness. When you make a statement like that, yeah, we're the biggest and the best. Are you really self-aware enough to know that maybe you're creating a myth for yourself, that maybe you aren't that bigger, that better. Maybe there needs to be some introspective, and you need to understand yourself so you can be a better lawyer, number one, so you can be a better father to your child, so you can be a better husband or spouse. So I think self-reflection, the first 3 books I wrote about it was In Search of Atticus Finch, the second one, Clarence Darrow, The Journeyman, and the third one was called Resurrecting Aesop. And all of those books were driven by actual efforts to, I sent out questionnaires, and I had hundreds and hundreds of lawyers responding to the questionnaire, which in and of itself is interesting if you think about it. When you get a 4-page questionnaire and you say, that asks you what causes you stress, what causes you to be the happiest practicing law, what causes you to be the most miserable, and they start responding, you know that that's important. And so that's what happened with all 3 of those books. And they all focus on the need to really understand ourselves a little bit better and to be honest with ourselves about what brings us happiness and what brings us quality of life. You know, in the end, money doesn't bring us quality of life. Bigger and better and the best doesn't bring us quality of life unless the best is simply being the best you can be in all parts of your life, as a trial lawyer, as a father, as a spouse, as a community member. That's best, you see. And that reflects how you are as a trial lawyer.
How do you balance everything? Because as you pointed out, you are a very successful, obviously, attorney. You are an author. You have a nationally syndicated radio show that you host called Ring of Fire. You have a television host of America's Lawyer, which is a television program on the RT network. Books, just came out with a new book, Law and Vengeance, which is a follow-up to your Law and Disorder book, which is a legal thriller. Love to have you tell us a little bit about that. But first, how do you balance all of this?
Well, it's all balanced around priorities, first of all. The relationship I have with my law firm is they know that I'll try 3 or 4 major trials for them every year for the law firm. And there was a time when I was doing 10 to 12 a year. And so at this juncture in my life, the understanding is, well, you'll do 3. Can you do 3? Can you do 4? With that, I'm able to build a life, a quality of life that doesn't have me every day in the hunt, every day worried about, am I bigger? Am I better? Do I have enough business? It allows me the luxury of being able to live a little bit. And what I mean by living a little bit is, it would be an awful thing to check out of this whole thing, to end your life and say, you know, I was a good lawyer and I worked really hard and I made a lot of money and I have a big car and a big house and a boat and an airplane. What does that mean? Well, at the end of the day, what does that mean for anybody? What kind of legacy is that? Is that your legacy? Or is the legacy, say, I left you something to think about. I left you 7 or 8 books. You may hate them all. You may like them. Read them. What do you think? I left you innovations in how to practice law. Mass Torts Made Perfect, RT America, Ring of Fire, National Trial Lawyers, all these things that I've tried to innovate with and to build over the years. That's legacy. That's legacy that my child will look at and say, yeah, that, you know, Dad was something besides just a trial lawyer. Or he was something besides just a business getter. You see, what's happening right now is we don't even have, some of these lawyers don't even think about their quality of life. They don't even think about the time that they have with their family. It's all about, interesting thing. When I saw the results on the first questionnaire that I sent out to lawyers, this is startling, but this is what I found. It wasn't a question of, do I have enough? You see, that wasn't the question. The question wasn't, do I have enough today? Or do I have enough, where am I going to have enough 20 years from now? That wasn't the problem. They got into the problem when they could not get past the question, do I have more than the other guy? And when you saw those lawyers that answered like that, and you went back and looked just a little bit, just did a little bit of due diligence to see how did their life go. It was miserable. Most of the time, it was miserable.
This is a very tough profession. Let's stay on that point. What are the secrets of your day-to-day success then? I mean, you've made it in so many different ways. But for those listening who are earlier in their careers, what can you share are the secrets that have been your day-to-day success?
Well, to innovate. That's number one. To innovate. The lack of innovation, lawyers are, Clarence Darrow wrote a really incredible statement. He wrote 50 books. But in one of his books, or maybe it's one of his speeches when I was doing research, I saw that he had said that lawyers, for the most part, are not very great thinkers. They're not great readers. They're not innovative, except in their narrow world of practicing law. That's destructive. If you're getting such a myopic view of your life that you judge everything by that myopic view of what am I doing only as a lawyer, and you don't innovate. See, it's easy to wake up every day, pick up the same coffee cup, drink out of the same coffee cup the same way every day without ever really understanding that there's a better way to do things. And that better way sometimes brings you a better quality of life. Because you're not like a horse pulling a wagon down a road. You're not pushing that big boulder up the hill like Zephyrus. You know, you're not caught in that trap. Because every single day you're getting up and saying, what can I do that's innovative? That's what I think about when I write books. It's what I think of when I built Mass Torts Made Perfect, 18 years worth. Now it's one of the biggest programs in America for trial lawyers that do mass torts. That's what I thought about when we built the National Trial Lawyers. That was something different. It had a different brand to it. That's what I thought about when I built Ring of Fire, which was a political entity, which allowed us to tell political stories along with the legal stories. That's what I think about every day when I go and do a segment on Ring of Fire or on America's Lawyer. You see, it's innovation. And because that brings quality to your life.
Even though you are working in a legal system that is, by its very nature, has rules and procedures and laws and statutes, you can think outside the box?
You have, if you can't abandon those rules that you've been given, if you can't tomorrow morning walk into your office, throw the damn coffee cup up against the wall and break it and say, today I'm going to do any, you know what it is? It's innovate or evaporate. That's it. And that brings great quality to your life.
How do you handle disappointment?
Life is simply a whole series of peaks and valleys. I don't care who you are. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care what your education is. I don't care what your intellectual capabilities are, what your social status is. For everybody, life is simply a series of peaks and valleys. It is as accurate to say that as it is to say that two balls will fall from the sky at the same rate, at the exact same. It's a physical law. And everybody experiences peaks and valleys. The Orientals had a term that they used, the golden mean. They said, let me try to adjust my thinking to where I'm not overjoyed at a success. I'm not deprived when things go bad. I'm not depressed. But to try to say, okay, if I'm at a low point right now, imagine what that peak is going to look like. And it's true. And it is so difficult for us to get our arms around. We think there's something magical about that person that, you know, does something extraordinary. Well, that same person has a valley too. And it's the same way for everybody.
Looking back so far on your legal career, is there one particular case that you won't forget?
I think all of them are important. But if I look at the spectrum, I would say the one that changed me the most would probably be the Factor 8 case. The Factor 8 case was a case where you had Bayer and a couple of other manufacturers. They made a blood coagulation drug, and it was made for hemophiliacs. And they sold it to hemophiliacs, mostly children, and male children, since male gene carries the hemophilia. And so these kids started dying of AIDS and HIV-related diseases. And we found out that the blood that they were using to make the Factor VIII had been contaminated by HIV because they were getting the plasma from the absolute worst parts of town because it didn't cost much money. Well, then after they were caught doing that, you would have thought they would have destroyed, you know, all the extra. The inventory would have completely been destroyed, you would hope. But instead of doing that, what they did is they sold it to other countries without warning anybody. So they sold it to South America. They sold it to Asia. And in there, I saw the very darkest part of what a true sociopath CEO can do. I saw what upper management is actually capable of doing. And it changed me. It didn't just make me into a cynic. I'm not a cynic. But it made me into more of a fighter. And it made me understand that I have got to be the best trial lawyer I can be because compromise doesn't change a damn thing in this world. You sitting down and compromising does not change a thing in this world. The only thing that changes anything is when you really hurt a company, when you put somebody out of their job because they made a decision they knew was wrong, when a CEO understands that their career could be over with because of something they've done. Because you can't count on the government doing that. You can't count on if a CEO is dressed up in an Armani suit with a Rolex watch and he drives a Bentley, he's not going to prison. Put a hoodie on him and he's going to prison. You know, put him on a street corner with a hoodie, he's going to prison. So what you have to be able to do, you have to be skillful enough to first have the level of anger, the level of just absolute disgust and anger to motivate you to change that world, change that little part of the world on that day. And tomorrow it's going to be something else where you change that little part of the world on that day, step by step.
How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, it's saved my career. You know, lawyers don't understand is they're out there making money. You know, they're making money day to day. Who in the world do they think is protecting their right to do that? The only people we have carrying our spear in the state of Florida is the FJA. You know, that's it. That they are day to day while we're out there, you know, muddling around with what we do, thinking what we do is so damned important. We forget that what we do is only, we can only do it because the FJA handles the politics, because the FJA understands that day to day they have to do their job or Mike Papantonio can't do his job. So the impact on my practice has been huge because I've always recognized that.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? What concerns do you have?
My biggest concern is that it's become more of a business. It's become such a business that the number of trial lawyers that are actually out there are just, you know, almost disappearing. Some of the biggest advertisers, for example, in this state, you know, you see their ads everywhere. And you say, well, how many times did you go to trial? And the reason that's so important is because the ability to try a case and the ability to really go after a wrongdoer, an insurance company or a corporation or a polluter, somebody who's done wrong, and you know it's wrong, and it's not just negligently wrong, it's reckless, it's a conscious disregard for their right, for people's rights. You can't do that without trial skills. You know, you can be a case getter. You know, you bring in, oh my God, I bring in 4,000, you know, you can make that argument, bring in 4,000 cases a month. So what? What have you done to change anything surrounding that area that you said you brought in 4,000 cases? What have you done? Mm-hmm. Was it a pharmaceutical company that you brought 4,000 cases in? What did you do to that pharmaceutical company in a courtroom that made them change the way they do business? So I'm disgusted with the level of how this has become a business. It's become a business rather than turning out people who have the ability to really change things. And you can't do it unless you're a trial lawyer. You can joke, you can kid yourself till hell freezes over about how you're making an impact. You're not making an impact unless you have the ability to go toe-to-toe with the biggest damn corporations in the world, not just America, but in the world. When you say, I can do that, and you're comfortable, and you've done it, and you've gotten results, then you are doing something that you should be proud of as far as your legacy.
And to your point, that means not accepting $1 million to settle and walk away when it's really worth $5 or $6 or $10 million on behalf of your clients.
Great example, DuPont, you brought it up. The only reason I talk about it, this is true almost in every case. First people involved with the case were ready to settle the case for, you know, $20 million. And, you know, it affected tens of thousands of people.
And $920 million is what.
And that's just the first phase. Settled for $920, and that's just the first phase.
Wow.
Yeah.
What one piece of advice do you have for incoming lawyers?
They don't understand that they should be playing their own game. If you watch a tennis match, I mean, really, really great tennis players, they don't adjust their match according to what the other person's doing. They play their game. When they walk, same way with a great trial lawyer. A trial lawyer walks into a trial with his game, his or her game, and he's going to deliver that game. And he'll adjust slight adjustments if he has to, if she has to, but it's their game. But most lawyers always want to just be me too. Oh, Joe or Mary's doing this. Well, me too. You know, rather than saying, let me forge out something very special for my practice. Let me build something that's so unique and so innovative that Bob or Mary, let them mess with workers' comp and, you know, fender bender cases. I want to do something different. So we just are, most lawyers are so damn insecure about it that they has to, it's this me too mentality that they have to do the same thing the same way that everybody else is doing it, rather than saying, I'm going to bust out, I'm going to visualize my game, I'm going to be able to see what that game's going to look like 10 years from now and then go do it.
And you found and realized, and you build on your own passion, it's clear.
And well, you better have passion in the practice of law. When I started practicing law here with this law firm, I mean, Fred Levin, I mean, how was I going to compete with Fred Levin's personal injury practice? Really? I mean, you know, he just won the biggest case maybe 3 years before I started, he had won the biggest case in the country, Thorshov railroad case. So I'm going to come and compete with that? Or am I going to build out my own thing, which is what I did. As I built out my own reality, it was an alternative reality, but it was my own reality.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
No, I don't think you ever end up there. That's the kind of thinking that I rejected. You know, coming out of law school, I had a lot of job offers to go to work with defense firms and say, yeah, I'm going to be a defense. I mean, can you imagine You wake up every day and you say, oh, I had a real successful day today. You know what I did? I prevented a widow and three children from recovering money that they were entitled to because this company killed their father. You know, that's the defense mentality. The reason people go there sometimes is because they're too willing to say the ends justify the means. You realize these cats talk themselves into believing that what they do really is important? They really do. They come out of law school, they're the top 1% of the class, they're law review, they're, you know, incredible intellects. Where do they go? They go to corporate defense firms. Why do they do that? This is what's really going to surprise you. Most people that do that, the reason they do is because they're afraid of rejection. They're afraid of being that guy, that person that's outside the norm. They say, I'm going to go to this silk stocking law firm who's going to pay me a lot of money this first year. And maybe, you know, 6 years later, they're stuck in a time warp. But they're going to pay me a lot of money this first year. But you know what really attracts them? The normalcy of it attracts them. The idea that I'm going to be a member of the country club. They're going to put me on, they're going to put me on the golf team. I'm going to be in this luxurious office with all these movers and shakers and silk stock lawyering lawyers. I'm going to be part of all that normalcy, that establishment. That's who goes to these firms. They can't stand rejection. And you see it in trial. These same people who show up 10 years later, they finally get their first chance to try a case. They still can't stand rejection. And it makes them horrible lawyers. But all along the way, they're willing to say, you know what, I'm going to compromise. Yeah, what I'm doing, I know I'm destroying some documents. Probably I shouldn't do that. I know I'm not being honest in this discovery. Probably shouldn't do that, but I'm going to do it because the end justifies the means. Interesting quick story. Clarence Darrow never made a dime in a really big way practicing law. As a matter of fact, when he first got his license, he went to work for L&N Railroad. L&N Railroad wanted him defending corporations that were killing widows and orphans. One day he went into the office, one particular case, he said, you know, I can't do this. And they said, why? And he simply said, because what I'm doing with my hands doesn't line up with what I feel in my heart. And that's where lawyers fail themselves. They say, oh, wow, I'm going to go to work with this incredible Covington Burling in Washington, D.C., because they'd offer me a lot of money. Well, what the hell are they asking you to do? What are they saying you have to do for that money? And I don't know why we can't get past that. And if you go to every law school and you really sit down and talk to those kids who say, yeah, this is good for me, they're all going to have some very specific traits. And their inability to think outside the norms, their inability to operate on the edges of the norm, their inability to handle rejection is non-existent. They just cannot stand rejection.
Interesting. Mike, how would you like to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered for somebody who stood for something, you know, who left something behind. Mostly, I don't care if I'm ever remembered beyond what my child and my wife think about me. How about that?
Mike Papantonio, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.